From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's sports program, Only a Game. When Sunni Saad, an American-born soccer player, joined the Lebanese national team, he didn't immediately realize the team would face North Korea. When the time came for that road trip to Pyongyang last month, Saad thought about contacting his teammates.
You guys need me for this one? Or you sure? I can just chill.
Saad's explosive visit to North Korea is just ahead on Only a Game. Also, an empire on the brink where sports and politics become intertwined. Stay tuned. Sunni Saad grew up in Dearborn, Michigan with three siblings.
And soccer was basically my whole childhood. We all played together on the same team, with my father being the coach. That led me into the direction and the career path that I've taken today.
Well, that and considerable talent. Sunni Saad plays professionally these days for Sporting KC in Kansas City. Not the first story about a kid who parlayed his love for a sport into a career, is it? But this guy's soccer career would take him to more places than most people see in a lifetime, at least one of which he'd prefer to have avoided. Sunni aspired to play for the U.S. national team, the one that competes for the World Cup, sometimes. But despite his MLS experience and a couple of years playing professionally in Thailand, he didn't get the call from the U.S. coach. But his play did impress the coach of the men's national team in Lebanon. He knew Sunni's father had brought the family from Lebanon to the U.S. before Sunni was born. Pair that circumstance with the Lebanese team's modest standing in the world soccer table. They are currently considered the planet's 100th best team, and you can understand the coach's interest. So, in November 2016, Sunni Saad suited up for Lebanon and began checking out the team's itinerary for Asia Cup qualifiers.
It was Hong Kong, Malaysia, and North Korea. And in the back of my mind, I was always thinking, North Korea, like, that means we have to travel there.
Yeah, only in the back of his mind, because the trip to North Korea wouldn't come around for a while. But the months passed, another autumn arrived, and the trip to Pyongyang loomed.
That's when it hit me, and I was like, geez, man, we have to go.
And on other days, Sunni was like, geez, man, maybe I don't, and maybe I could say something to the manager.
You guys need me for this one, or... You sure? I can just chill. I was definitely afraid that I would be held at the airport when I landed. I was afraid that they were going to go through my laptop, my electronic devices, maybe see that I'm from America, or even see my American passport.
When the time came to board the plane for last month's match against North Korea, Sunni took precautions.
I grew out my beard to look extra Lebanese. I'd even spoken a Lebanese accent when I spoke in English. I really hid the fact that I was American.
He held on to his Lebanese passport. He handed his U.S. passport to the team manager.
I said, hide that. Give it to me on the flight back to China.
The tension for a U.S. citizen who wasn't Dennis Rodman arriving in North Korea was palpable. Not everybody made it out on schedule. Not everybody made it out. Sunni says it first began to feel strange when the team landed in Pyongyang.
It was the first time that I stepped into an airport and didn't hear a thing. It was silent. I mean, there was no PA announcements. There was no buzz or chatter. It was just quiet.
Wherever they went, Sunni and his teammates were accompanied by guides. That was no shock. But he did get a surprise when he was taken to his hotel room. There was a TV there. So information of a sort could come in, though the Lebanese team couldn't communicate with anybody back home while they were in North Korea, which was too bad because on the morning of September 3rd, 2 days before the game, they had something to report.
I woke up at 5 a.m. and I heard outside this eerie music. Maybe it was the national anthem playing in the streets. Or maybe it was the military compound, but not far away, playing something. But I also heard chanting. I turned to my roommate, who's from the UK, and we're like, what's going on? We looked outside, kind of freaking out. We turned on the news, and it says,
주최 배구 2016년 1월 6일 10시 주최 조선의 첫 수소탄 시험이 성공적으로 진행되었다.
Suni speaks just enough Korean to be able to understand a line of that broadcast.
North Korea test hydrogen bomb.
Yeah. Suni Saad, U.S. citizen with a day job playing soccer for Sporting KC, was in North Korea when Kim Jong-un tested a hydrogen bomb, President Donald J. Trump having threatened him with fire and fury. But later that morning, when Suni left the hotel, life seemed to be going on as if the world might not end that day.
I'm not sure if the population even knew what was going on. But generally, I mean, everyone was walking on the streets. You see children playing in the streets. It didn't seem like anything had changed.
One thing that hadn't changed, the explosion of a powerful nuclear device notwithstanding, was the soccer schedule. 2 days after Suni and his teammates had learned that they'd been within 100 miles of the test, they marched into the stadium in Pyongyang, where 31,000 people were prepared to greet them.
And it was loud, and everyone in the stadium had these wooden clappers. And at the halfway line, there was about 12 or 15 cheerleaders that were girls. They were wearing army uniforms. They would all call out in sync, I'm telling you, in sync. Their heads would move in sync, their bodies would move in sync, and they would all chant something. And at first we're like, oh, like this is all they got, just 15 girls chanting. And then all of a sudden, after the girls would chant something, the entire stadium would just erupt chanting that same thing.
Which must have been pretty impressive. North Korea scored first. Suni Saad didn't start the game, and from his perch on the Lebanese team's bench, he noticed something he'd never seen before.
They gave their elderly the front seats of the stadium, kind of the lower seats where it's easier to see. And the elderly were able to wear whatever they wanted to the stadium. But the majority of the stadium was university students, and they all wore white with a red tie. So the stadium was all white except for the section of the elderly.
Suni's stint as an observer ended in the closing minutes of the match, by which point he'd blocked out the distractions the trip had involved.
I ended up coming into the game in the 86th minute or something like that. We were down 2-1, and we were able to score in the last minute of the game to tie it 2-2.
Lebanon 팀에서 동점골을 기록했습니다.
It was a point on the road for Lebanon, a triumph unappreciated by those 31,000 North Korean fans and the TV play-by-play guy. And as soon as the game was over, Suni Saad became conscious of those distractions the game had banished. He began thinking again about what it meant or what it might mean to be a U.S. citizen in North Korea while the leader of that nation and the U.S. president were shaking their missile-clutching fists at each other, and his thoughts turned to home.
ASAP. I said I wanted to leave that night, but I couldn't even leave the next day, unfortunately, because the next flight out of North Korea was on Thursday, and we had played on Tuesday night. I'll tell you, Wednesday was a very long day.
The one thing you probably wouldn't want to do on a very long day in North Korea is let on that you're from the U.S., right? Right?
I actually told the North Korean tour guide, I was like, actually, you know, I was born in America, and I live in America. And the guy was nice. He's like, yeah, we like Americans. We have no problem with Americans. And I was like, oh, that's good to know.
Good indeed. Maybe even hopeful. Still, the game was over, and Suni was very pleased when the plane carrying his team finally took off. He was even more relieved when it landed.
I can't believe I was excited to be in China, really. I never thought I'd say that. I can't believe I was that excited to land in China.
Suni Saad's back in a Sporting KC uniform this week. They play this weekend at Rail Salt Lake. Probably won't even feel much like an away game to somebody who's been on the pitch in North Korea. From a story that starts with a father playing soccer with his sons, we move now to a story about a mother and daughter. Athletic pursuits are involved, but the setting is less exotic.
I had talked my daughter into coming to the gym. She was home from college, fit and flexible and dear. Talking her into the gym had required effort. She's very busy, and also the gym can be alienating. Large men sometimes drop heavy weights with grunts. Their efforts at self-improvement aren't private, and the ground shakes when they're done. Then when they don't remove their piles of 50-pound cylinders after using the machines, leg presses are impossible. Who needs that? But there we were after much finessing and inducement. The treadmills and ellipticals were finished, and we were stretching on mats. Her hair was pinned into a high-flying ponytail, tendrils shooting out athletically, and her face was flushed. She looked dewy and radiant, though such are a mother's eyes. A young trainer came up beside us. I've often noticed her working with clients. Just like my daughter, she is fit and flexible, sure of herself, the next generation of feminist. And like most trainers, her conversational muscles are also in excellent shape. She could talk a stone into 12 more reps. When she dropped down on one side of me to do her own stretching, I felt myself between two pillars of youth. A few minutes later, she glanced sideways and realized that my daughter and I were together. She leaned over in the friendliest way. "You go, girl," she said cheerfully to my daughter. "Bring in your mother to the gym. I can never talk mine into it. I can't talk her into anything." My dewy, radiant child blushed. She's one of those moral beings who can't be around untruths without confessing immediately, even when it's not her crime. I felt heat rising. This was a moment yearning for light. Then I stopped. Was a lecture really worth the time it was about to take? There were nothing but good intentions on these mats, three women from two generations trying to better themselves and wishing the same for each other. Maybe we had accomplished enough for today.
Alyssa Eli is a community psychiatrist in Massachusetts. After two seasons with the Pittsburgh Steelers, Baron Batch became a full-time artist, and it was his work as a painter that led to his encounter with the Pittsburgh Police Department and an arresting officer with an unexpected message.
I admire your artwork, you know, even though it's some of it's, you know, it's illegal.
That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR. I'd like to thank Paul Westland for leaving the following review of Only a Game on Apple Podcasts. Great, intelligent, and listenable take on sports. I love Charlie Pierce's regular segment, and I always listen to the end for the last word. But today, wow, this morning's show on college athletics may be the best hour I've ever heard on radio. Did you miss last week's show on the NCAA and amateurism? If so, it's available now on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, go ahead and subscribe. It's the best way to make sure you never miss a moment of Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield, and it's time for three stories you should know. We're now in week 7 of the NFL season. There are no longer any undefeated teams, but heading into the weekend, there were 15 teams with exactly 3 wins. Parity, or perhaps mediocrity in the NFL. That's where we're going to start this week. I'm joined by Michael Lee of Yahoo Sports and Mike Pesca. He's the host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist. Welcome back to both of you.
Hi, Bill.
How you doing?
Mike, I know I can count on you to discuss mediocrity in a way that's not mediocre, so off you go.
Yeah, elevating the mediocre discussion past the 50th percentile. Here I go. So Kevin Clark wrote about this in a really definitive way on The Ringer, and it was something that I was feeling. Now, I want to disclose, I love football, but there was something bothering me about this, and it was definitely not the national anthem protests. It just seemed that there was very few games where I was saying to myself, gotta watch this one. I mean, I will watch most football games, but there weren't those, oh, let's watch this game. And so it really does turn out that there is just built into the system, and mostly because of the salary cap, that you can't have great teams, and it's very hard to have sustained greatness. And when we've seen sustained greatness, it's because of one player, a Rodgers or a Brady, who are so good, but also probably making less money than they could. It seems the NFL, for all it wrings its hands about where it stands societally and if they're doing the right thing with head trauma, answer no, and off the field issues with domestic abuse, answer incomplete. the way that they've concocted their league guarantees just a dissatisfaction in terms of excellent teams being allowed to be excellent.
I'm dissatisfied for a lot of reasons with the NFL, but I can say that for the last couple of years, the parity has made the game less interesting because there just aren't enough teams that you care about. And there's a team that everyone hates in the Patriots, but they're actually a dislikable team that you don't even want to watch. So it's just a really hard league to get behind. They don't promote their stars in the way that basketball does or baseball, you know, baseball needs to. But I just think that the NBA just has it right. Their stars are out front and center, and they've established super teams. And I think when you have great teams, you have great interest.
Could football promote itself the way the NBA promotes itself? The NBA guys are out there in their shorts and shirts. You can see them. You can see their facial expressions. The football guys are out there in armor.
Well, I just think that, you know, you've made it a completely quarterback-centric league. So you have to have a quarterback that has a personality or you don't have a good team. You know, in the past, you had running backs. You had guys that in different positions that you could promote. I remember Deion Sanders was a superstar supreme, and he's somebody that you wanted to watch every week. And he was had a helmet on, but he also took a helmet off, and you could see the Jerry Curl dripping and the gold chains around his neck. And there was just so much excitement and flair. I think the league, you know, shut down, was a no-fun league for a while. Now they're allowing guys to celebrate in the end zone and do things like that. But it's really tough when you make the whole league about passing and about the quarterback, and you don't allow the other position players to really become stars.
Mike, you talked about the difficulty of sustained greatness. Maybe the NFL is just like all other walks of life. It's really hard to find sustained greatness anywhere, isn't it? Maybe we should be identifying with what's going on in the NFL and seeing ourselves there.
I don't know. Apple's on a winning streak, and Google seems to be doing well. And
Amazon is
not so good. Congress is not happy with Google and Amazon, I've heard.
Well, I'm just saying if you invested in them 20 years
ago.
Oh,
I see. All right. Yes, okay.
Yeah. I think, actually, let's talk about Piketty's theory of rent-seeking behavior. I think that there is a snowball effect, and once you have some good things, and it's because of system that you put in place, most systems perpetuate themselves. Sports are antithetical to this because they want to give the worst team the number one draft pick to make them a little better, and I understand that to some degree, but there's no sport that disrupts the building of a dynasty more than the NFL with its salary cap, and there are a lot of other things. I'll agree that it's harder to promote a guy who's not wearing a tank top whose face you see, but they very much quash the personalities of their players. My point is the whole league and the whole culture, as Michael was saying, of the NBA is so much more interesting and so much more driven by personality. I think that the NFL thinks that the word personality is equivalent to something like hip-hop culture. That just may not be true, but they've never given it a chance. They're very scared of players having a personality, and that's part of the situation they're in.
Let us turn to a team that's been very far from mediocre for a long time. Michael?
Yeah, the phrase trust the process has been used so much in Philadelphia that depending on your vantage point, it either leads you to hold on to hope for the future or to vomit from the wretchedness on display every night. For the past 3 years, the Philadelphia 76ers engaged in a rebuilding effort that was all about intentionally losing on the grandest scale possible to stockpile high draft picks, with the plan being to secure the best odds at a potentially franchise-altering talent or talents. The extreme measures were controversial and recently led to the NBA to reform its draft lottery system to shut down any copycat offenders. But the talent has finally arrived in the form of Joel Embiid and the past two number one picks in Ben Simmons and Markelle Fultz. The process is processing, and fans in Philadelphia are excited. There's some buzz that they can make the playoffs this year, but that's expecting a lot. The foundation of this team remains young. The wait for the 76ers to become a real contender could be several more years. Tanking is widely accepted in baseball, with the strategy yielding the past two champions in the Kansas City Royals and the Chicago Cubs. No team has really attempted this path of success in the NBA. But how long is too long to wait for your team to become great?
I think this trend is, this is how you play the game, and we shouldn't hate the player, we should hate the game, but it's the worst trend in professional sports, like being bad on purpose for a long time. Mm. I'm a Jets fan, and I actually weirdly, perversely take joy in victory as a fan should, and yet I'm on a text chain with three other Jet fan friends of mine, and they just hate winning. It makes no sense. And the one thing I take exception with, Michael, you talked about, you know, those long-suffering Sixers fans, and I'm sure they were suffering, but I don't know how much they were sticking by their team. Sixers were last in attendance in 2015, right? Third to last in attendance in 2016. Still below average in attendance last year. So they were punishing fans for a long, long time.
Michael, I want to bring up something involving the Sixers fans as well. Will the circumstances that you've described change the behavior of fans in Philadelphia, not only in terms of coming to watch the Sixers play? Because over the years, those fans have produced some really memorable moments, going all the way back to when some genius in the publicity department of the 76ers decided the phrase of the year should be, "We owe you one." And the year after that, it was, "We owe you two," because they blew the championship again. I mean, are things going to change in Philadelphia as a result of all this?
That's what I'm saying. I don't know. There's such a risk in putting all your eggs and saying we're going to just draft and get lucky. Because even if you get that top pick, even if you get that player, he could still become a bust, you know? So it's a big risk. And if you look at the teams that have won championships over the last few years, it's not the ones that have drafted all the number one picks. It's the ones that have used other means to build a quality team. So it's a risky proposal, and they've asked their fans to suffer through the process, but you just never know if you're actually going to get a reward for it.
Draft, and we're going to get lucky? I was under the impression the draft was a science. It involved analytics. There was no luck involved at this point.
It's all luck. Unless you believe the ping pong balls are rigged,
yeah,
then there's something
BBs
else
in
involved.
The ping pong balls. I know about that. As always, we save our most important story for last, gentlemen.
We save it from me?
Yeah, yeah. I would love to say I got a shaggy dog story for you this week, except the dogs that are involved are not especially shaggy. They're huskies. And some of them have tested positive for a banned substance, and they're competing in the Iditarod sled dog race, and it had never happened before this year. I can take longer baseball games. I can take corruption in college basketball, ongoing controversies about kneeling on the football field, whether it's free speech or misdemeanor treason. But when the dogs are cheating, it's too much. I'm going to write about something else from now on, I think. Sports is done. Michael, are you with me?
I am not, because you know how I feel about performance-enhancing drugs. I want to be entertained. And if you want to put your body at risk,
you
want to put your health at risk just to keep me entertained, do what you got to do. Mm-hmm. And if dogs want to entertain me by taking some drugs, I mean, let's be honest, I mean, what kind of drugs are they putting in our food nowadays?
I don't want to know. but it's not working because my performance is not especially enhanced. Mike, what do you think? Is the Iditarod going the way of the Tour de France?
Bill, how in denial could you have been? Look at these competitors. First of all, a couple of these dogs have fur like all over their bodies. Second of all, Tippy's slashing
huge.
Opposite field power, going for 30 home runs after being a slick fielding infielder. Tuffy's collar size has gone up four sizes. Come on, Bill. You knew it all along.
I just wasn't paying close enough attention, I guess.
nothing's sacred anymore, Bill.
No, nothing is. Of course, in defense of these four-legged athletes or the humans who drug them, because last time I looked, the dogs didn't actually have fingers and thumbs and would have trouble getting the pills out of the pill bottles. Anyway, I got to say that if I had to run through snow and ice night and day for a long time, I'd want all the painkillers that I could find. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Michael Lee of Yahoo Sports and Mike Pesca. He's the host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist. Thank you, both of you.
Thank you for having us.
You're welcome.
All Our next story is about a guy who knew exactly what he was going to do after college, and he did it, and he loved it, and then, when he didn't want to do it anymore or couldn't, he found something else to do that he also loved. Lucky guy, huh? Sure, except this one little thing. Sarah Kovash has our story.
It wasn't until Baron Batch left the NFL that he attracted the attention of the Pittsburgh Police Department. One of Batch's favorite things to do is ride his bike. It's one of the only forms of exercise he can do since tearing his ACL during training camp in his rookie season with the Pittsburgh Steelers in 2011. It was while riding his bike along one of Pittsburgh's riverfront trails that he stopped to spray paint a message. Batch didn't stop there.
I had this tag that said, "All your scars are lovely," down by the wharf. That's where I like ride my bike, and I'd always get off my bike there and stretch my ankle. I have no cartilage in my ankle. It's just grinding bones. I deal with chronic pain every single day. So at that spot, you know, I was riding one day and stretching, and that hit me like, "All your scars are lovely."
Batch was drafted in the 7th round by the Steelers in 2011, but his injury in training camp meant he was out before the season even began. He played in 12 games the next season, but was ultimately cut by the team. He retired from football in 2013. His retirement allowed him to follow his true passion. Batch became a full-time artist. I met him on a Monday while he was painting an elephant, one of his signature images.
I'm just like Monday, like Monday work. It's making sure that I have at least like 4 good paintings that are just like my signature, you know, style, just the elephant that I feel comfortable with, like, putting out. And it's like a warm-up, but, you know, I'm getting a product that, you know, people really want out of it.
Batch started his company, Studio AM, about a year after leaving the Steelers. Young Pittsburgh residents took notice and began sharing his work on social media. Batch relished the attention. He started doing what he calls art drops, where he would leave one of his paintings in a public area and post its location on social media, free to the first person who could find it.
The painting was the honey that drew him there, but like the experience and the exhilaration in that is the art. That's what they take with them.
He turned his studio, located in the Pittsburgh-adjacent Rust Belt town of Homestead, into a brunch venue and gallery. On Sundays, visitors eat fruit-covered French toast and savory rice dishes while chatting with the artist. It's not the same crowd you'd find at a Steelers tailgate. Last year, Batch was commissioned for a mural project. He created 20 pieces throughout the city, mostly on the sides of buildings. Many featured his brightly hued elephants. Their neon pink and yellow trunks cover the garage doors of an abandoned industrial building. A headdress-clad skull with the phrase "Rise and Shine" covers another. It was a project he hoped would take his brand to the next level.
That's a huge component to like taking the step to get your art out there.
As Batch spent more time on outdoor murals, he moved from the surfaces he had permission to paint to some he didn't.
You know, I just got so comfortable with painting on things outside. Pushed the boundaries too far.
Over the next couple of months, he painted other colorful messages, some on a bridge and a parking lot. It never occurred to him that he was breaking the law. His friendly pops of color added bits of levity to struggling sections of the city. In some spots, he painted on buildings that are literally crumbling away. That marriage of fresh art and old buildings is in many ways indicative of Pittsburgh's renaissance.
Pittsburgh is just this massive urban jungle that is beautiful, but a lot of these spaces just haven't been thought about in a different way, in a different functionality, and beautifying them and bringing art into those spaces changes the way they're used and seen and the function of them.
Batch was creating some of the most inspired art of his career. But his project was quickly halted when the police showed up.
We went over to his studio over in Homestead. He was there, and we kind of took him by surprise. He wasn't expecting us.
That's Detective Alfonso Sloan of the Pittsburgh Police Graffiti Squad. In all, police said Batch caused more than $16,000 worth of damage. They charged him with 30 counts of criminal mischief. And it was social media, the thing that arguably helped make Batch's art career, that got him in trouble.
We just read the comments, some of the things that he had posted himself about the graffiti, and kind of pretty much told on himself.
Batch had to pay $30,000 in fines and legal fees. But he says his arrest also led to a much-needed discussion about public art. Part of that conversation was with the Friends of the Riverfront. That's the group that manages the trail Batch graffitied. The group gave Batch permission to paint a section of the trail that's lined with concrete barriers that were left behind when a concrete factory closed its doors. Batch and volunteers painted about 20 of the barriers this spring in various shades of blue, purple, orange, and pink. They call it the Color Park.
It was kind of an industrial-looking area that, when color was added to it, gives it a whole new vibrancy that it didn't have in the past.
That's Jeff McCauley. He's with the Friends of the Riverfront. But that's not all. Again, here's Detective Sloan.
I explained to Baron that that I was an artist myself ever since I was like 13 years old. And I explained to him, you know, like, hey, I admire your artwork, you know, even though some of it's, you know, it's illegal. You know, he said, okay, well, you know, I'm an artist and you're an artist. How about we get together sometimes? And we worked on several projects, and the main project was the art show over at Space Gallery.
Sloan and Batch helps a group of low-income teens create a mural in the downtown gallery. It features a large red heart held by two hands and encouraging words such as power, positive, and unique.
I saw it a beautiful storyline to be able to put together that project with my arresting officer.
Sloan says he thinks Batch has made amends for what he did.
He offended some people, but a lot of people, you know, when they came out to the show, they were looking for the guy that painted the trail. Like, hey, that's Baron, you know. So he kind of has a fan base and a hate base at the same time.
Batch doesn't regret his graffiti or his arrest.
I would happily break the rules every single time. It's not harm anyone, but it is helping and transforming.
But Detective Sloan hopes Batch doesn't test the city's graffiti laws again.
We would have to arrest him again. You know, we explained that. I don't think that he will, but I'm hoping it was just a one-time thing. I hate to arrest someone. You get to work with them. You actually like them.
Sarah Kovash produced our story about former Pittsburgh Steeler, once and perhaps future scofflaw, current artist Baron Batch. You can see photos of some of the artist's work at onlyagame.org. Coming up, a story of sex, violence, and sports.
Pretty much the whole lot, yes.
That's just ahead on Only a Game. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
Once upon a time, there was a podcast. A podcast that told stories, especially for kids. This podcast gathered folktales from around the world and found amazing actors to bring them to life, including some you might recognize from movies and TV.
Dear wise old woman, you are a genius!
Yep, that's Jason Alexander from Seinfeld.
You won't believe this!
I'm Rebecca Shear, and this podcast we're talking about, it's a real thing. It's called Circle Round. And whether you're a kid, a grown-up, or young at heart, we're coming your way this fall from the WBUR iLab. Hear the first episode now on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And come circle around on our website, wbur.org/circleround.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, a look back at the career of the most notorious cheater ever to fumble away an easy chance or otherwise rig a baseball game. But right now, it's time for my conversation about the weekly news with Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
The Los Angeles Dodgers are in the World Series for the first time in 29 years. Why does it feel like it hasn't been that long since the Dodgers were in the World Series?
Because they've been kicking around the playoffs for that long. They've never been really bad. But they just never been able to get past folks, most notably the Cardinals.
For a long time, Commissioner Rob Manfred and lots of other people have been trying to make baseball games shorter. They've all failed. And during this postseason, the games have been even longer than they were during the regular season. And during the regular season, those games set a record for length. What, if anything, can the commissioner or anybody else do?
Three-inning baseball. One-inning baseball. Finish the season in a week and a half. But I still think the one way you can speed up the game is to actually enforce the time between pitches, which they still don't. There's still entirely too much personal grooming going on between pitches.
Portland is now on the list of cities that might get an expansion baseball franchise. Are we sure Maine is ready for MLB?
Oregon, Bill.
Oh,
Oregon.
Sorry.
It's a little bit less ridiculous. They have a blueprint for a state-of-the-art baseball-only stadium with a retractable roof, it being Portland, where it rains 392 days a year.
You know, it doesn't. I've actually been there on a sunny day from time to time.
Yeah.
Have you spoken to the commissioner about Havana?
No. You know, as Butch Cassidy said, I got vision, the rest of the world's got bifocals on that one.
Lonzo Ball made his much-anticipated debut with the Lakers on Thursday night. Now that he's actually playing, no more nonsense surrounding him, right? He's just a basketball
player.
Well,
worse than that, LeVar Ball, his father, made his NBA debut.
Speaking of nonsense surrounding him.
Yeah, Patrick Beverley of the Clippers played very good defense, held him to 3 points and 4 assists and 9 rebounds, and then really kind of trash-talked him all the way up and down the floor. And then, of course, LeVar had to go to ESPN and point out that whatever Patrick Beverley does, he is going to make as much money as LeVar Ball's son is. If I'm Lonzo Ball, I'm filing one of those lawsuits which, like, divorces you from your parents.
You step away.
This guy is fully capable of wrecking this kid's NBA career.
This week, the NFL came out in favor of criminal justice reform.
Okay, can I just stop for a minute?
I can't imagine why.
Well, I mean, it's not like they don't have experience with the criminal justice system.
Well, I think that's they're certainly
no.
The right
people. I mean, I too am in favor of criminal justice reform. You know, good for them. I mean, this is an issue that was supposed to gain wide bipartisan support, and then the election happened, and it's sort of fallen off the radar. Good for the NFL for trying to bring it back.
But my question is, now that the NFL has said this, does it mean that the players say, okay, we'll all stand up now during the national anthem?
No, they're not going to do that, and it looks like the commissioner's backed down to the players on that one. He's now saying the league didn't tell them to commit to standing during the anthem. I just, you know, the anthem's going to be the anthem for the rest of the season. People should just stop talking about it and let it happen. It's not like half the stadium isn't at the beer stands anyway.
In this week's probably totally meritless lawsuit department, I present the following for your consideration. Former Louisville men's basketball coach Rick Pitino is suing Adidas for inflicting upon him emotional distress. For what? Showering him with $800,000? How distressing. Counselor Pierce.
Objection. Assumes facts not in evidence.
He's taking this seriously.
The cause of action. The cause of action is not because of showering him with $800,000. It's because of their decision to no longer shower him with $800,000.
I see. Okay. Does it hurt or help Mr. Pitino's case that Louisville fired their athletic director this week?
Well, it gives him another witness. Maybe a co-defendant or a co-plaintiff. Who knows?
The president of Rio's 2016 Olympic bid has been charged with corruption.
No! I
don't know what's more shocking, that Carlos Nuzman was so careless or that FIFA doesn't appear to be involved in this because it's the Olympics.
Well, I mean, the only international sporting body that gives FIFA a run for its money for being utterly, totally corrupt and evil is the International Olympic Committee. I mean, they're charging him with helping to run a criminal organization that, you know, helped pay for votes, essentially helped to buy the Olympics for Rio. And the evidence includes, and this is my favorite, undeclared assets in the form of 16 gold bars.
Huh.
What did this guy do, rob a train in 1856?
And then he just kept going. Finally, Charlie... Lindsey Partridge was waiting in line to check into a room at the Super 8 Motel in Georgetown, Kentucky, when she heard a clerk give the person in front of her permission to bring her dog into the room. So Ms. Partridge said, "Can I bring my horse into the room?" And the clerk said,
"Yes, of course, because this is Kentucky."
And the horse said,
"Just show me to the ice machine, Wilbur."
How many people will be checking in with you, ma'am?
You think the answer would have been the same if the woman asking the question had been a partridge? You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time, and he joins me each week on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Once upon a time, there was an empire that seemed to be on the verge of collapse. Sports, always popular entertainment with the people of this empire, had become intertwined with politics. Protests were held at sports stadiums. Political leaders responded to these protests. I am, of course, talking about the Eastern Roman Empire during the 6th century. Here's Only a Game's Martin Kessler.
The first thing you need to know about the Emperor Justinian is that his motto was essentially, make the Roman Empire great again. Justinian came to power in 527 AD, about 50 years after the fall of the Western Roman Empire. Justinian ruled the Eastern Roman, also known as the Byzantine Empire, out of Constantinople.
He felt, I think, fairly strongly that the Roman Empire had taken a huge hit before his reign.
That's historian Mike Dash.
And that it was his duty, really, as emperor, to try and reconquer as much of that as possible.
The second thing you need to know about Justinian is that he married a prostitute, and not just any prostitute. She was
the most scandalous woman of the age.
Her name was Theodora, and she was the daughter of a bear keeper. As was likely the fate of many bear keepers, Theodora's father died unexpectedly. A lot of what we know about Theodora comes from a contemporary historian named Procopius. Theodora grew up to become an actress, which Procopius explains had a very different meaning back then.
She became a courtesan, and such as the ancient Greeks used to call a common one at that, for she was not a flute or harp player, nor was she even trained to dance, but only gave her youth to anyone she met in utter abandonment. There was no shame in the girl, and no one ever saw her dismayed.
That's actor Eric Chung reading the words of Procopius. It's believed that Justinian attended one of Theodora's performances and was absolutely smitten, which explains how a bear keeper's daughter turned courtesan ended up as empress. Theodora may not have been the obvious pick for the job, but she was smart, and she understood the citizens of Constantinople, qualities that would one day play a critical role in preserving Justinian's reign. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Back to sports. The imperial pastime was chariot racing.
They were massively popular events. I mean, they were the NFL and the MLB rolled into one in terms of sporting entertainment.
During the days of the Roman Empire, leaders tried to win favor by putting on elaborate games. Gladiatorial combat had mostly died out by the 6th century, but most cities across the empire had their very own chariot racing stadiums. The biggest of all was right in Constantinople. It was called the Hippodrome. It was about 4 times the size of a football field and shaped like a massive horseshoe. It held around 100,000 people. A secret passageway connected the imperial palace directly to the imperial box where the emperor would watch the chariot races from his throne. Imagine the Queen of England having her own tunnel directly into Wembley Stadium. Down below, up to 12 charioteers, each pulled by 4 horses, raced around a track just 150 feet wide. Deaths were common. It didn't help that spectators sometimes tossed nail-studded tablets onto the track. They also wagered large sums of money on the races. At the time, there were 2 rival chariot racing teams, the Blues and the Greens. Both had big followings in Constantinople, and this is where sports and politics really become intertwined.
There is one group of historians who essentially say that the Blues and the Greens were effectively almost prototype political parties. The Blues were the sort of party of the authorities. The emperor himself, Justinian, was a well-known partisan of the Blues, and the Greens were the party of the plebs, the people.
As I said earlier, Justinian was focused on taking back the Roman Empire's lost territory. But war costs a lot of money. So Justinian raised taxes, even on wealthy people. And wealthy people do not like being taxed. So the citizens of Constantinople grew frustrated. Here's the ancient historian Procopius again.
Not all the Blues were willing to follow his leadership, but there were plenty who were eager for civil war.
Civil war may not have begun at the chariot races, but fights regularly broke out in the stands. And that brings us to the year 532.
It's really a powder keg. And what happened in 532 was that there was a fight in the Hippodrome between the partisans of the Blues and the Greens. The local police force, which essentially is the Imperial Guard, waded in to separate the two sides. And there was a trial and 7 men were sentenced to be hanged.
The hanging was scheduled for a few days later on the banks of the Bosphorus. The first 5 men were successfully executed.
And then the gallows collapsed as the last pair were being hanged.
We're not really sure why the gallows suddenly collapsed, but
the crowd took this as a sign that they weren't meant to die, and they waded in and rescued the 2 guys, one of whom was a Green and one of whom was a Blue, and they hustled them off to sanctuary in a nearby church. So you have a situation where, for once, the Blues and the Greens, in a sense, are united against the government, and that's really where it all starts going sort of horribly wrong.
Yes, even more horribly wrong, because at the next chariot race, the partisans of the Blues and Greens return to the Hippodrome, and
rather than fighting each other, they suddenly start showing rather disconcerting signs of being on the same side. And the words that they're screaming are ones that you very often hear in chariot races at this time. I mean, they're just shouting out, Nika, Nika, which is Greek for win, win. Normally, you would use that to encourage your charioteer to win the race, but it becomes rather obvious that what they're really talking about is the victory of the greens and the blues over the emperor. So what happened was that the order went out, you know, shut the races down now. We've got to regain control of the situation. And when the Hippodrome was shut down, the crowd streamed out into the streets of Constantinople. And rather than dispersing, they began simply to burn the city down.
According to Procopius,
fire was applied to the city as if it had fallen under the hand of an enemy.
While the city burned, Justinian holed up in the imperial palace. A day passed and the rioting didn't stop. Then another day passed. Still no sign of stopping. The rioters returned to the Hippodrome and made it a sort of headquarters. This must have made the emperor nervous. Remember, the Hippodrome is directly connected to the imperial palace. To try and appease the mob, Justinian dismissed his hated tax collector. That didn't work. The rioters continued to burn the city. Justinian grew more and more anxious. On the fifth day of the riots, the Blues and Greens appointed a new rival emperor, who is seated on the throne inside the Hippodrome. Justinian considered fleeing.
Well, this is where Theodora really sort of proves her mettle. I mean, she said to her husband,
"If you, my lord, wish to save your skin, you will have no difficulty in doing so."
This is Erica Lance reading the part of Theodora.
"We are rich, there is the sea, there too are our ships. But consider first whether, when you reach safety, you will regret that you did not choose death in preference. As for me, I stand by the ancient saying, the purple is the noblest winding sheet."
In other words, you should die rather than give up the power of being emperor. And she shamed Justinian into staying and fighting.
Justinian gathered two of his generals. He told them to plan a counterstrike. According to one apocryphal account, one general appeased the Blues by bribing them with gold coins and reminding them that Justinian supported their side. But historian Mike Dash says the truth is likely far more brutal. One general led his troops through the Hippodrome's main entrance. The other used the Imperial Guard to barricade all the other exits, trapping the lesser armed and disorganized rioters inside.
You know, numbers tend to get exaggerated, but you know, we are told that 30,000 people were killed inside the stadium in less than a day.
The newly appointed rival emperor was executed, and his body was tossed in the sea. As Procopius puts it,
"This was the end of the insurrection in Byzantium."
Justinian's power was once again secure. As an extra screw you to the people of Constantinople, he even reappointed that dreaded tax collector. Justinian ruled for another 3 decades until his death in 565. And Justinian and Theodora left the empire in a powerful position.
It lasts for another 900 years after his death. At no point in that time does it have the borders as wide as the ones that Justinian set for it.
But chariot racing would not recover from what would become known as the Nika riots.
Because what we've seen is what can go horribly wrong when the people get too excited by these games. So what happens, in fact, is that people start putting their passion not into chariot racing, but into theological debate. And people start forming new factions rather than, you know, over blues and greens in the Hippodrome, over different interpretations of verses in the Bible.
Ah, but that's a story for another day and another show.
That's Only a Game's Martin Kessler. To read more about the Nika riots, check out Mike Dash's article for Smithsonian Magazine titled "Blue vs. Green, Rocking the Byzantine Empire." You can find a link at onlyagame.org. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder. We had additional help this week from Greg Eklund. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our intern is Brian Bouchard. And our senior producer is Karen Given. Our final word comes from the historian Procopius, who was a bit hesitant to share the tale of Justinian and Theodora.
"I fear they may think me a writer of fiction and even put me among the poets."
A designation most unfair. I hope that I won't end up there when someone says, "I hope," while grinning, he has played his final inning. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game, and thanks for listening.